The same things that make cities annoying for some also make them green. So many people cram together, living in smaller spaces, walking, biking, and taking the train because cars are more trouble than they're worth, keeps New Yorkers from driving too much, buying more things than they need, and using too much energy. Some would argue that a lot of green space, the sort of thing we find in the suburbs, often isn't green at all. Joining me now to talk about a new book called Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development is Joan Fitzgerald, a professor of urban studies in Boston. Her book is published by Oxford University Press. Also with us is Dan Miner, chair of the Sierra Club's New York City chapter. He also works for a business development nonprofit in the city. Welcome to our show. Joan, your title Emerald City suggests that there are many. How many did you look at?
I looked at, I wrote about maybe 20 cities, but looked at many more, and particularly in Europe, that where the cities are much further advanced on the sustainability agenda in the United States. But I wrote about cities in the United States.
How many cities in the United States are even comparable to Europe?
I'd say there's 5 to 10 that are comparable to the best practice in Europe.
And how did your background in urban planning influence the approach that you took when you were looking at these cities?
Well, I'm of the view that cities are the most sustainable places on the planet because of their density. But I think climate change is a hard sell to a lot of people, and it's increasingly we see the American public's prioritization of climate change diminishing. And so I think it's important to point out that there's an economic development component to climate change, and that cities, states, our country can be innovating with clean technologies, and that there's a lot of opportunity in climate change as well.
I received an email today from some organization claiming that claims of climate change are just a sham. And, you know, I'm always surprised when I see that because it seems to me the evidence is quite clear. Why do you think so many people resist it?
Because it's scary, because it's way off in the distance, and because they think it will require significant changes in their lifestyle.
Dan, has anybody done a study about the attitudes of New Yorkers? Do New Yorkers have, are they afraid of the, or do they resist the notion of climate change?
I'm not sure if there's been a study done on New Yorkers per se, but Pew Research Center has done a number of studies on American attitudes towards climate change, and they've seen, as you mentioned before, that the American public simply does not find climate change to be an urgent and compelling public concern. Out of 30 issues, climate change is all the way at the bottom, with only 28% of Americans seeing it to be an urgent issue. Part of it is, as per a Columbia University study on climate change communication tells us, because people see the impact of climate change to be very far in the future, to affect people far away, and to be scientifically unclear and uncertain, which is true if you're not fairly up on the science. Also, there have been opposition groups that have spent a lot of money to artificially create confusion about the science, as you mentioned.
We normally think of cities as unhealthy places because of air pollution, high crime rates, etc. But the argument here is that cities can be beneficial to the environment. How does that work?
I would completely agree with what Joan said. Obviously, people who are living in the city benefit from a lot of efficiencies, potential efficiencies in real, as far as buildings, housing, transportation, and density. And the question for New York City, as well as other American cities, is how can we reduce the inherent structural limitations of the American city, often built after World War II to be dependent on cars, and move towards the model of European cities that were built before that automobile-based transportation paradigm.
Like New York, where sprawl is not as much a concern as it might be in Los Angeles or Albuquerque or Phoenix.
True.
As long as we're talking about, you mentioned economic development, Joan. How do you define economic development in this regard?
I define it by creating new sectors or industries in the economy around renewable energy, around energy efficiency. There's a whole industry around making buildings more energy efficient, even in trash. how we get rid of our trash can be an economic development opportunity. So it's creating the next wave of industries around clean technology, but it's also creating jobs for residents.
And the president cited that as one reason for the country to go green, but nobody seems to have bought it in Congress. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they have to some extent. You saw some money going into workforce development, some money going into energy efficiency, certainly some money into research on renewable energy. I think where the problem is with the energy bill is around how we're going to tax carbon. And if we're going to tax carbon, are we going to do cap and trade? That seems doubtful right now. And that would generate the money for investment in green that's needed.
There was an article in the New York Times recently about how some European countries, Denmark in particular, are using trash as a source of energy. There was talk about how American environmental groups like the Sierra Club, I think, are opposed.
The best thing to do with trash, Leonard, is to recycle it, and better still is to produce as little trash as possible to reduce the tremendous amount of materials that are wasted as we operate our society. And the better thing to do is to focus on energy conservation and renewable energy and energy efficiency. So burning trash for fuel really should be a last resort.
Even if we can find ways to keep it clean and if it eases our dependency on oil?
It would be better, but in order to ease our dependency on oil, we really need to focus much further down on the chain. By the time you're talking about a pile of trash and turning it into energy, the entire analysis has been kind of missed.
You know, I'd like to disagree a little bit in that if you look at the countries, Denmark, many European countries, their recycling rates are much, much higher.
They have more bins in, I remember, in Germany, something like 3 or 4 recycle bins. We do 2.
Well, if you look in Tokyo, you'll see as many as 20 because they sort out all the different types of plastic as well. But I don't think they're mutually contradictory strategies in that, again, you know, you've got recycling rates of 42% compared to where I live. It's about 14%. So I think the American public is a long distance away from recycling everything. And I think the clean technology for burning fuel in Europe is something that we should consider in some of our major cities.
Is Boston not a good city for sustainability?
I think overall they are. There's a lot of very promising initiatives, but like many cities, they struggle with recycling.
Even more than New York. And in New York, we had a big debate a while back when Mayor Bloomberg came into office. He wanted to pretty much suspend recycling efforts.
He did, but fortunately there has been some good news. The city council recently came out with a number of initiatives to tremendously expand the types of materials that are recycled, and local environmental groups are very supportive of this advance in the city's recycling policy, which will hopefully move us towards the European cities that have the higher recycling rates.
My guests are Dan Miner, chair of Sierra Club New York City and a staff member of a nonprofit business development organization, and Joan Fitzgerald, who is the author of a book called Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. It's published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Joan, in your survey of Emerald Cities, how green does New York turn out to be?
New York turns out to be very green by virtue of its density and by virtue of its public transportation system.
Wouldn't Boston be similar because it's an older city and public transportation is important?
For the same reasons, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So New York, Chicago, to some degree San Francisco because it's kind of an older city on the West Coast?
San Francisco comes out very well, Portland, Seattle. But actually, one of the cities I talk about in almost every chapter in the book as being a green city is Los Angeles.
Big surprise to me.
It's a surprise to everyone when I say that. But, you know, again, for the very reasons you mentioned, New York and Boston started out on third base in terms of the run-up to be the greenest city by virtue of their density in public transportation. When you have a city that's sprawled in the way Los Angeles is and has the pollution problem it does, no infrastructure on public transportation, it takes quite a bit of effort. And that's what they're doing. They're moving on every front. Los Angeles has a almost 70% recycling rate. They're building public transportation. They have, I think, the largest energy efficiency program in the country.
Well, I remember going to Los Angeles many years ago, and you could see the air. And I'm assuming that to some degree this is the result of the fact that people realize that if they continued going the way that they were going to just kill themselves every time they took a breath.
Right. It's one of the few places where people have voted to tax themselves to build public transportation. They had an enormous effort to clean up the port. So they've got a long ways to go, but are really working on all fronts to get there.
Dan, some have argued that Manhattan is one of the greenest places in the country and a development model that should be emulated. What are the elements that make Manhattan so green? And is Manhattan more green than Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, or Staten Island?
Obviously, Manhattan is a lot denser, Leonard, but I don't think we need to increase the density in Queens and Brooklyn or compare that. It's happening to a certain degree. The question is, what can Manhattan or any of the boroughs do to increase the amount of energy efficiency, conservation, renewable power, and the kind of good urban policies that we've heard about here? How can parts of New York City keep moving forward? Because even though we are, in fact, a very green city, we shouldn't miss the opportunity to do even better, because, in fact, we'll have to.
A listener, Amy from Manhattan, points out that cities also concentrate demand, that she's found it easier to get organic food in New York City than in towns closer to where some of the food is actually grown. She says, and I couldn't find recycled paper towels in a supermarket outside of Albany when it was common for stores in New York City to carry any number of brands of recycled paper products.
She's right about that. I was a year ago on sabbatical in New York and lived off Union Square and was able to purchase just about all of our groceries from local producers at the square. But there's also another element to what she's talking about, in that cities can influence with their purchasing and purchasing of green products, or running their fleets on efficient vehicles, setting an example that large cities have an advantage for.
And it has. This means that cities actually have to make plans, actually have to do more than just simply say, well, we're a big city with public transportation, we're doing fine. What are some of the initiatives that you've seen in this city and in others that you think are particularly hopeful?
Well, in New York, it has one of the most comprehensive, along with Chicago, climate change action plans. And it's a plan, it's about building parks and green space, it's about building efficiency, it's about recycling, it covers all aspects, and there's milestones and periodic assessments of how they're doing on the plan. And so when I look at cities, it's a matter of looking at how comprehensive those plans are, how they're prioritizing the key elements that they have to, and depending on the city, it's either buildings first or transportation first, then going down to kind of the things that have an impact but aren't quite as important, such as recycling. But then there's all kinds of things in between related to energy usage, getting that down, promoting renewables, promoting green products, that cities have quite a bit of influence if they do planning well.
Dan, can you tell us about PlanYC? That's PlanYC. Which was introduced by the Bloomberg administration in April 2007.
The Bloomberg administration deserves a great deal of credit for introducing PlanYC, which is an enormously comprehensive and broad effort to think about how the city can be more sustainable in the year 2030. However, it's still a work in progress, and there's a lot more that needs to be done, both in terms of the city expanding and updating the individual initiatives and looking for ways that the city's population, neighborhood groups, and civic groups can develop a greater buy-in and help become active participants in the city's ongoing effort to become yet more sustainable.
Well, there are parts of the plan, like congestion pricing, that have not that the administration hasn't been able to get anybody to go along with. Do you think that that would have been something positive?
I think it would be positive, and I think a lot of this has to do with the way that climate change and sustainability responses are sold to the public. Because as we heard before, the climate change issue is often lost in the public. What I found in my reading is that individuals are more likely to accept these initiatives when it's framed in terms of what's in it for me and how can I move in this direction to limit my near-term losses from future energy price hikes, which is also coming, and that's an issue that the city has not fully dealt with and really needs to explore.
The Bloomberg administration based congestion pricing on the way London does it. Is London the only city that has this kind of approach?
Stockholm has it as well, where it's been highly successful.
Do people in the cities like it? Those cities like it?
Well, in fact, it was a trial period for Stockholm, and there was the public sentiment was against it. And within a year of its trial period, the public voted to continue and expand it. And there's a couple of Asian cities that have it as well, but Stockholm and London are the two key examples. It requires a certain type of city that has a limited number of access points, major points where people commute in.
Well, in the case of London, I can't imagine there being a limited number of access points because it's a city of such small, winding streets. But they seem to have worked it out.
Right, where people come in from outside the city.
A listener, Ken from the Upper West Side, says he's just returned from and somehow survived a bicycle trip to Midtown Manhattan. He says that he thinks that New York still has a long way to go.
It certainly does have a long way to go, Leonard, but that shouldn't discourage us from moving forward as best we can. And that's why we need to think about what are the directions in which we should go, as Joan is pointing out, and also what are the best ways to frame those directions and to encourage more participation, more public support. Like going back to congestion pricing, if the initiative was sold as a way of increasing traffic speed in Manhattan by a few percentage points or reducing airborne particulates, that sold, I believe, only a small amount. If it's framed as a way of funding the transportation infrastructure improvements that New York City will need to be functional in its future, especially when energy and transportation prices increase, I think that would be a much more persuasive way to sell it both internally and externally at state government levels.
My guests are Dan Miner, chair of Sierra Club New York City, a staff member at a nonprofit business development organization, and Joan Fitzgerald, professor and director of the Law, Policy, and Society Program at Northeastern University, also director of the Urban Studies minor and teaches at Northeastern's new Masters in Urban and Regional Policy program. She is the author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development, which is published by Oxford University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Joan Fitzgerald, author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. It's published by Oxford University Press. Also, Dan Miner, chair of Sierra Club New York City. Dan, there's a movement called Transition Towns. What are they?
The Transition Movement is a British-based community organizing method in response to climate change, fuel depletion, and economic crisis. And it's focused on bringing together people, informing them about the multiple different challenges that all of our communities face towards sustainability, and getting them to engage with each other based around a positive vision of where their community can be in a certain period of time, much more sustainable, also much more resilient to the challenges that the near-term future holds, and encouraging people to work together proactively, not waiting for government in order to make changes in their community.
Well, this sounds to me like something that could be done in neighborhoods, but is it possible in a city as large as New York?
One of the questions that we're working with here is how can we transform a British movement that has been very successful in smaller towns to large American cities. And the focus, as you point out, is translating it into terms that most Americans, most New York residents are familiar with, And part of that has to do with the neighborhood framework. So one of the things that Sierra Club New York City Group is promoting is the idea of encouraging neighborhood civic leaders to come together and jointly co-sponsor a sustainability event where we jointly discuss what are the good sustainability and green programs already operating in the city that can be brought in not to a central Manhattan location but to a easily accessible place in their community. So the community leaders can collaborate in presenting to their residents the green services that are already up and running but need to be better distributed to New Yorkers. And once again, it's focusing on benefits that New York City residents can take advantage immediately, along with tying it to a positive vision and a request for grassroots participation.
Go ahead, Joe.
If I may add, an interesting way of building awareness that I found is a city in Australia, Newcastle, and decided it was going to be one of the most energy efficient cities. And they have.
They didn't want to bring coals to Newcastle?
No, they didn't. A different Newcastle, but it's actually a coal town too. But one of the things they have in their downtown is a huge billboard, and it actually plots the energy use of the city. And then they have 12 districts in the city, and they have competitions in districts, but also within schools about which district can bring its energy usage down. So it makes people aware on a day-to-day basis of how much energy they're consuming, how to go about changing that. That I think is a good way to go about it.
Now, I wanted to keep, and this may sound petty, but I wanted to produce my own compost. And so I went looking for worms, which are a part of the whole process. Do you know how hard it is to get worms in New York City? There's only one place you can buy worms in the whole city, and that's the Green Market at Union Square. No, you have to go to Glen Cove if you want to not go into Manhattan. And that struck me as the opposite of this kind of situation. After all, the boroughs are where much of the outer boroughs are where much of this activity is taking place. And yet nobody seems to have figured out that if you make these things available to people, they might very well take advantage.
And the answer is we have to create awareness that these responses exist. Now, I'm probably one of the few people in Queens who has a worm bin in their office. And I think that's...
Where'd you get your worms?
From Union Square Green Market.
$11 a half a pound. It's
a lot
of money.
Yeah, but it was okay, and the worms seem happy. But right now, that's where you get the worms. However, in the future, as more people know about this and it becomes recognized and acceptable thing to do in New York City office buildings, more and more people will get worm bins, and they will become available throughout the city. And that's the kind of thing that we need to encourage.
I think that's true, but I also think it's a very limited way of going about it. So you have to have a bottom-up building awareness. But the fact of the matter is most people in New York City are not going to use worms or other composting.
You'd be surprised if they could.
But I don't think most would want to, and I don't think it would be. So we need to have policies about do we want to collect organic waste from which you can make compost, you can make energy, and many big cities are doing it. On the West Coast and elsewhere. San Francisco is doing it, collecting organic waste. That's the policy and planning solution that we need.
Well, they collect organic waste at the Union Square Market as well. But that's the only place you can really go with that. And it just seems to me that in a city as large as New York, there should be any number of places where people can bring that stuff. Joan, you cite the example of Freiburg, Germany, and how they were able to arrive at a strategy for sustainability after deciding that they didn't want a nuclear power plant.
Right. What they did in Freiburg was then develop a plan for an alternative. So if we're not going to be a nuclear city, we're going to be a renewable energy city. And in order to do that, they had to create the demand. So they put solar panels up on almost every city building. They created incentive programs for residents to purchase solar. That also created an industry. And they, to this day, have a strong solar panel manufacturing industry. Many of the companies that were developed as a result of this are operating today as international companies and leaders. What's interesting about my example of Freiburg is that the policies that were developed in Freiburg, Aachen, and other cities, something called a feed-in tariff, where the government says all utilities have to purchase all the renewable energy that is produced at a set rate, create demand. And the German government then copied these city policies. So it's kind of cities as laboratories of democracy, of policy. And as a result of that, from 2002 up until 2007, Germany has been the leading exporter of solar and wind technology. So it shows, first of all, that cities can be innovators in policies that national governments can employ. And it also shows that you don't necessarily have to have the product resource. Germany's not the sunniest country in the world, nor is it the windiest.
Actually, and yet Germany it's an exporter. Has the most cloud cover of any country in Europe. But none of that could have been done without the government putting a lot of money into it, because right now solar energy is not really cost efficient. So, I mean, it winds up being a political decision as well, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. But what Germany saw was this was a real economic opportunity for the country to create the next generation of technologies that were going to drive their manufacturing sector, that were going to drive exports. And so it was irrelevant how much resource they had. And that's the whole idea of these policies. Of course, solar is not competitive right now, but to allow the research to continue to make it competitive the way wind has become.
Dan, haven't some neighborhoods in the city already formed coalitions around sustainability?
There are a couple of neighborhoods that have gone a very far ways in bringing an integrated awareness of sustainability initiatives to the people in their community, and it's a good thing and something we certainly want to encourage. And I would say that's a building block toward the idea of advancing city policy, because it's quite true. It's nice to have a couple of personal initiatives, and that's a way of building public demand for the large-scale urban, city, and national progress that we need. And we can't make progress in developing very proactive city and national policy without broad public support. And if we find some takers for that in individual change and in individual communities, that's a good place to start. So by supporting neighborhood-related sustainability networks that can encourage individuals to move forward, it will help build the demand for city and national progress.
Joan, let's talk a little bit about green jobs. Mm-hmm. What are some of the initiatives you outline in the book that train people for green jobs?
There's a number of them in different areas. The most obvious one is to train people for installation of solar panels. But there's also a lot in the construction trades around energy efficiency. So many of the things that we're calling green jobs are jobs that already exist but becoming green. I talk about initiatives in Pittsburgh and Syracuse to transform existing industries, green building supply, indoor environmental quality equipment, to green building supply. And there's an initiative in New York City by the New York Industrial Retention Network that promotes industries and works with companies in helping them transform their products into green products that will be used either to make buildings more efficient or to build new buildings that are more efficient and have many features that consumers want around the types of paint and carpeting and shading that are used.
How important are social justice considerations in determining who gets to participate in these programs?
It depends on the city. Let me give you an example. In Los Angeles, it has, as I mentioned, this really large energy efficiency initiative. One of the things that they're doing is low-income neighborhoods first. And then in addition to that, they're working with their community colleges to develop training programs for people in those neighborhoods so that they're actually doing the efficiency work and then can train for those jobs elsewhere as well. So I think in many cases it's a matter of where the initiatives are being employed in the city and then employing those workers to do it.
A listener wonders, Dan, if how realistic it would be to put solar panels on roofs in New York City or rooftop gardens.
It's extremely realistic. There was a major study done about solar panels in New York City a few years ago that suggested that with rapid scale-up, 17% of the city's electricity supply could be provided by solar. We certainly get a lot more solar exposure than Germany, and it's a terrific and important place where we can move forward.
Can't these things be stimulated by changing building codes? In New York, there just only recently people were allowed to keep bees, something that they had been doing for a long time illegally. Bees are only good for the environment, aren't they?
Well, keeping bees are good, but just going back to the earlier point, we need to have major municipal progress towards installing a lot more solar panels, and that's going to be supported by things like the feed-in tariff and by modifications of city building codes and procedures to make it easier for entrepreneurs and for contractors and building owners to install solar power. But even beyond the solar power, which we need to look at ways to maximize energy conservation in existing buildings, because it doesn't do any good to get an extra amount of solar-powered electricity into the building if the air-conditioned air that the electricity is generating is leaking out. So we need to start with the conservation before moving towards renewable power, even though that's necessary too.
Looking, since we're on roofs with solar panels, I mean, two things that you can do, and Chicago is a leader in this, is green roofs, which deflect a lot of sun, as well as just painting roofs white that can save 10 to 20% on
the heating and cooling. Because it must be
black. Right. So they're absorbing sun and then cooling the air.
Good in the wintertime, bad in the summertime. Two rating systems for buildings are LEED, is that called LEED?
Mm-hmm.
And Energy Star. What are the strengths and weaknesses of the systems?
Well, the LEED system has been modified in 2009 to make it focus more on energy efficiency. Historically, the problem was that it focused on a number of design features, but if your goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, its primary focus has to be on energy efficiency. That has been improved, but I think your earlier comment is exactly spot on. LEED is voluntary, and a city can mandate it on its own buildings, and new buildings are a small number of the total buildings in any given city. It has to be through the building codes and energy codes. And one of the things that the stimulus does to receive a maximum amount of money, its city has to improve its building energy code. And that's where you'll really see high-level efficiencies.
Dan, one of the ways that the city remains green is through public transportation. Do you have a sense of how the proposed cuts to MTA services will impact the mix of passenger vehicle and mass transit in the city?
It's obviously going to be a challenge, Leonard, but New York City's mass transit is extremely important, and I think that the city is moving forward correctly in trying to de-emphasize automobile dependence and supporting walking, biking, and mass transit, and we should all try to cooperate and see where we can get the money to fund what we need to keep moving the city forward. Just to go back very briefly to the white roof painting, this is also a very important area we can get involved with, and some low-hanging fruit, and something that the Sierra Club is trying to recruit volunteers for. The city is identifying nonprofit buildings with flat black tar roofs and looking for volunteers this summer to paint them white, which lowers the electric bills for the nonprofits and keeps the cities cooler.
We have very little time, but just one other thing. Bill McKibben was here recently. He said we need the equivalent of a Manhattan Project or the plan to send a rocket to the moon to deal with these issues. Do you think it's that drastic?
Yes.
I agree.
One way that people can find out what might be possible is to read Joan Fitzgerald's book called Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. It is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us, Joan, professor and director of Law, Policy, and Society program at Northeastern University in Boston. Also with us has been Dan Miner, chair of Sierra Club New York City and a staff member of a nonprofit business development organization. It's been a real pleasure talking to the two of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Leonard.